Session number 8744, Eric Grinham, part one.
Mr. Grinham, reel one. Where do you come from, Mr. Grinham?
My home is Coventry, and I went to Birmingham before the war in 1939.
Which year were you born?
1918.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a coach builder.
And how old were you when you left school?
14.
To do what?
I went to work in a factory and then in a shop, as a shop assistant.
So how did you come to be in the forces?
Well, I joined the police force in Birmingham in August 1939, and then I was called up in the usual call-up, as any way I can put it. In 1942, it was a conscription. I couldn't go into the services before. I had to wait until I was called up.
Why was that?
Because the police wouldn't let you go, except on flying duties, which I didn't want.
What was your reaction when you were called up? Were you pleased or not?
I was quite pleased, because we'd suffered quite a lot of heavy bombing, both in Coventry and Birmingham, and I wanted to sort of have the chance to hit back and get the war over and get back to peace.
What was your attitude towards the regime in Germany?
Not very friendly. Somewhat hostile, if you like.
On what grounds? The bombing?
On bombing, yes. And the way I'd seen some horrible things in Birmingham as a result of the bombing.
And when you were called up, which unit did you go into?
I went into the General Service Corps at Bodmin in Cornwall. That was only preliminary training for about 6 weeks.
Was this the Army Service Corps?
No, it was General Service Corps.
What was its role?
Just basic training, just introducing you to military life.
So how did you come to be an SOE?
Well, from Bodmin I went to Barnard Castle, which was the RAC training depot. And from there I went to the 42nd Division headquarters in Somerset. And while I was there, they came round asking for volunteers for special duties. They didn't say too much of what it was. Those that did volunteer were interviewed, and I think it's at Tame Park. And from there, we went back to our unit and we were eventually sent for. And we were posted to SDS 54 at Henley-on-Thames at Fawley Court, and that was the start of my association with SOE.
Why did you volunteer for special service?
Well, the unit I'd joined was not a very good one. I didn't get on at all well with the NCOs. We were the first intake, and a lot of the Yorks and Lancs people there didn't like the new blood into it. I couldn't get on with the NCOs, and I knew I'd not get anywhere, so I took the first chance of getting out and doing something what I thought would be positive, and that was why I joined.
In what way couldn't you get on with the NCOs?
Don't know, it was just the feeling that I was a stranger amongst a unit that had been together and had in fact come out through Dunkirk. I didn't like the new people at all, and anyone non-Yorks and Lancs, they didn't like.
When you volunteered for special service, did you really know what it involved?
At first, no. But later, at Tame Park, it was explained to us, and then I realised what I was going into, and I thought, well, at last, I'm getting into doing something positive towards the war effort.
What did they tell you at Tame Park about the service?
Roughly that you would be trained and dropped into enemy territory in small parties, do a particular job, and then come out. But we would be trained as radio operators to go in with the parties.
What was your reaction when you heard that was involved?
Quite pleased.
Were you apprehensive at all?
No, I wasn't. I was all glad that I was doing something positive, as I said.
Were you single or a married man?
Married.
And did you have any children?
No.
Did your wife know what you'd let yourself in for?
No. And I never told her.
Why not?
Well, the security aspect. We were warned about the security and we had to sign forms to do with the Official Secrets Act. We had to do that at Tame Park.
So your wife had no inkling of what you were doing?
Not at first, but she had some idea as we got really advanced into our training, because I had to do a parachute course, and then she realised that I was doing something a bit different. I didn't belong to an airborne unit, I didn't wear a red beret, I kept my old unit badges, so it was obvious that I was not belonging to an airborne division. It was something different.
After they told you what it involved at Tame Park, did they give you the opportunity to drop out if you wanted to?
At any time, yes. A lot of people who went to Tame Park were either not accepted or they just didn't go, they just didn't want it.
You mean they dropped out after they heard what it involved?
Yes, they were no longer interested.
Did you speak to them?
No, I didn't. Many of them I didn't know.
Now, can you tell me what your training involved?
The main thing to start off with included physical fitness, radio training to SOE standards and procedures on their new types of codes, cipher, ground para training to start off with, silent killing, unarmed combat, all that kind of thing.
Did you find any part of it difficult to get hold of?
I found getting my Morse speeds up pretty difficult, but I managed it.
Was there any part of the training that you didn't like?
No, I enjoyed it. We met up with a very, very good crowd of men who were all enthusiastic. We came from all walks of life, and they developed a very, very good spirit of esprit de corps. I can't put it any other way. And we're all happy. Is the best way, happy to be in there and doing something. There was a very, very good spirit amongst the men.
What kind of background had your colleagues come from?
All walks of life. There were dockers, bank clerks, that's as diverse as I think as you can find.
And what type of units had they come from?
They were all armoured corps units.
Armoured Corps?
Armoured Corps, yes. All the radio operators were already radio operators in the Armoured Corps, which sort of gave them a start.
Were there none from outside the Armoured Corps?
Not that I know of.
What rank were you at the time?
Trooper, to start off with, and then we were, when we come up to a certain trade qualifications and certain standards in our training, that we were promoted sergeant.
After how long was that?
I think we'd been in about 6 months. Oh no, less than that, about 3 months.
And were your conditions of service the same as they had been before?
No, discipline was applied in a different way. We were not harsh discipline, but we had to maintain a certain standard of it, otherwise you just didn't fit in.
Were there any examples of the discipline whilst you were?
There were one or two who were weeded out after a few weeks. They were not suitable, they were kicking against the traces, and they were posted away.
In what way were they kicking over the traces?
Not knuckling down to work and not accepting the free and easy discipline. They were taking advantage of it and not knuckling down.
What do you think had been their motives for joining then?
I think in general to get away from what they'd been in.
Were there many of that type who had...
Only a few. Only a few.
Do you remember any particular personalities with whom you worked during this training period?
Oh, many. I still keep in touch with them. Quite a large number of them. They were very, very good friends, and we are still good friends.
Were there any famous people you came across?
At that time, no. We met General Gubbins, but we didn't see much of him.
What type of impression did he make on you?
He seemed to be a very, very fine leader. A man who sort of seemed to inspire one. Give you some encouragement, if you like. That's the best way I can put it.
What kind of a place was Tame Park?
It's a big country house, but we were only there for one afternoon or one day. We didn't stay there to do our training. We did our training at Fawley Court at Henley-on-Thames, and then our main training, once we got our radio speeds up, we went to Milton Hall near Peterborough.
What kind of a place was that?
It's a big country house. It was the home of the Fitzwilliam family. It's set back way off the road, and that's where we did all our training on the ground. The only thing we didn't do there was our parachuting, but we did do ground parachute training. All our field training, field craft, combined that with radio, it was all done there at Peterborough.
Now, can you tell me more about what you understood your own personal role to be?
Well, I knew that I would be the radio operator in a team, and I would not be with another radio operator. There would be teams of three, which consisted of one French officer, a British or American officer, and a radio operator of either or any of the three nationalities. And we were teamed up at Peterborough, and that we started to train in teams, so we got to know one another.
And who was in your own particular team?
The team leader was Major Craster. He was from the Oxenbucks Light Infantry. The French officer, I knew him as Lieutenant Carlier, but I found many years after that was not his proper name. All the Frenchmen had nom de plumes. His name was Cantaise. I still keep in touch with him.
Now, how soon did you expect to go into action?
We knew that we would not be going into action before D-Day. And when D-Day came, the teams would be assembled, they'd go away to London for briefing, and away they went. We didn't know when they went or where they were going, except that it was France.
When did your first attempted drop take place?
At the end of August, the 31st of August, 1944.
Can you describe what happened in as much detail as you can recollect?
Well, we'd gone down to London for briefing. We had a few lectures there because there was quite a few of us there. We went back to our billets, and then in the afternoon, Captain as he was then, Craster, came dashing in, "Get your gear together, we're going." We went from there to Tempsford. We were briefed about our mission on the way, and I had my final briefing when we got to Tempsford, all our radio plans and so on, and then we got on the Stirling and went into France.
What did you actually take with you?
On our person, just our personal kit. Nothing more than that. You couldn't parachute with a load on your back. That was impossible. You've got your small arms with you, and that was all. But the other stuff was in the packages dropped from the Stirling.
What small arms did you have?
A 38 Browning, a 45 Colt, And our main weapon was a Winchester carbine.
Were you happy with these weapons?
Yes. The carbine was nice and light and handy, it wasn't bulky, and it was sufficient for what we required. We also had grenades and that kind of thing. But
had what?
Grenades, metal grenades.
What about identification? Were you dressed as a British soldier?
I went in uniform, but took with me some civilian clothes, forged identity cards and passes, and we carried those with us. I've still got them.
You were in ordinary British Army uniform, weren't
you? Yes, yeah.
And what about the other two?
They were the same. The Frenchman had French uniform, of course, but he too took civilian clothes.
What kind of civilian clothes did you take? What did
well, I was documented as a labourer. And I took some roughish working clothes. So I had to look a bit rough, and that was it. Not that it worried me.
You mean dungarees and...
It was an old suit.
And a beret?
No, I didn't have a hat. And apart from my uniform beret.
What was dropped with you, apart from what you had on you?
Those arms, explosives, of all sorts. Most of that went to the Mackie. We had our own personal kit, and that was it. Because our radio, of course, was dropped with us too.
Was it all in one big package?
Well, there was a large number of packages. When the Stirling came over and dropped the... after we'd dropped, they came in. I thought the plane was falling apart. There was so much stuff came out.
Were you dropped before the packages?
Yes. We were dropped first. If I might put this one in, I must record my feelings as we were told to drop. And I went through the bottom of the plane. Was, well, you're on your way now. You can't go back. Make a man of yourself and get on with it. And I was quite thrilled to be going out and doing just that.
Were you scared as you dropped?
Maybe a little apprehensive, but not scared.
Were there people waiting for you?
Yes. A reception committee had been arranged, and there were a crowd of Frenchmen there with a whacking great big farm cart and horses to take the stuff away. Where it went to, I don't know. But we did eventually get our own kit, well, the next day.
Was it completely dark where you dropped?
No, bright moonlight. Brilliant moonlight.
Did they have any lights?
Well, they had to for the reception committee. And have the right signal, otherwise we wouldn't have dropped.
Could you see them signalling?
Oh, yes. They were in a line with the man with the giving the actual code signal was to one side.
And... Had you had any abortive drops before that? Any failures?
Not us, no. They may have been with other teams, but not with us.
Was the actual drop successful, or
yes.
Was anybody injured?
No, completely successful. I got a bruise on my backside, but that was having my water bottle on, which I shouldn't have had. But that didn't make any difference. That was the only injury I had.
What kind of an area was it where you dropped?
Typical country area, hilly maybe, but typical open countryside.
Was it wooded or not?
No, not where we were.
Was it cultivated or grass?
It was grass.
And did the three of you drop close to each other?
Yes.
And what happened when you hit the ground?
Well, after folding the parachute up, and a Frenchman came dashing round, shouting, "Where are you?" or in French. And we met up and we greeted each other, And then we were taken to the other members of the team.
How many people were waiting for you?
I don't know all told, but there were three who escorted us into the local village. The back ways, of course, through vineyards and countryside.
Did they not have a lot of problems collecting all the other packages up?
I don't think so. I think there must have been enough of them.
What was their attitude when they greeted you?
Very pleased. Very pleased to see us.
Were they nervous at all?
No, not in the slightest.
How were they dressed?
Just farm clothes, farm workers' clothes.
Where was it you actually dropped in France?
We were dropped near a place called Rivière-les-Fosses.
Where's that?
It's southwest of the town of Langres.
This is in eastern France?
Haute-Marne. I would say, mid-eastern France, if you like.
And where did they take you to? What did they do with you?
Well, we went into this house. We had a few drinks with them. And it was getting late in the night, so we went to bed. The next day, I unpacked my kit. It was brought to us, unpacked my radio. It was damaged. But I managed to patch it up. Whoever had packed it up had put it at the bottom of the package and the packing on top instead of vice versa. But I got it going and I came up on schedule with my radio and made contact straight away.
This was within a few hours of dropping?
Yes. Well, I suppose in about 6 hours of dropping. I think it was about 11 o'clock or something like that in the morning when I came up on the air and made immediate contact with England.
How did you manage to get it going?
Well, we just set the radio up and that's it. There were no problems, apart from hammering the case out, putting a new valve in, and it worked. It was a completely self-contained set.
And what was the nature of the messages that passed?
Well, first of all, that we'd arrived safely. But after that, it was asking for drops of arms and ammunition, arranging where they'd got to be dropped, signals that were going to be given, and dispositions of German troops and targets. And we gave some good targets, and we could get service, they said, within 4 hours, but I've known it quicker than that. Because on one particular occasion, a convoy of about 120 vehicles had stopped near the village of Bussière-les-Belmont, and they'd come there overnight. The locals let us know. I went upon the emergency schedule to England and told them about it, and the American Air Force came over with some 4 Mustangs, and they shot the convoy up. I was watching them coming in at very, very low level, going along the convoy, and they killed about 120 German soldiers. And there were 2 locals killed probably by exploding ammunition. But the RAF got the credit for it.
Why was that?
Well, we sent the message over, and the RAF had a very, very good reputation for doing a lot of damage to the Germans, and they got the credit for it. It was just as simple as that.
So it was just a mistake in good
faith? Just a mistake in good faith, yeah.
So the information that you were sending was all dictated by the French resistance, was it?
Well, they came in with the information, my 2 officers sorted it out, and then we encoded it. But we had to be somewhat selective with the information that we gave. We didn't take everything at face value that they brought in for us. We had to get it into something like order and priorities, if you like.
Why didn't you take it at face value?
Well, we found that people who were not used to getting intelligence in didn't always give accurate figures or places. And we had to work out map references and so on. So we had to reconnoitre and check.
You mean you had to go out yourself?
I didn't go out. I had to stay with my radio set. The officers would go out and get the correct information.
Did the officers become exasperated with incorrect information?
Not particularly. They were perhaps... They just wanted to get the things correct before they sent the information out. Because if we were giving targets, they had to be precise as to what they were going to hit or attack. So we wanted the information to be as correct as it was could possibly be.
So did you stay in this house the whole time?
We moved from Rivière-les-Fosses to another place, south of Langres. It was right out in the country, a country farmhouse. And that's where we did our operating from. That was near Bouchière.
How long a day would you transmit for?
Well, we had two periods on the air per day. One day it would be half an hour in the morning and an hour in the afternoon. And the next day it would be an hour in the morning and half an hour in the afternoon. But the times varied so that the chances of being DF'd would be lessened.
What does DF stand for?
Direction finding. So they couldn't pinpoint where we were operating from.
Were there any problems with local conditions for transmission?
No, none.
What about climatic conditions?
Never had any difficulty.
What about your batteries? Did you have adequate supplies?
Well, with that set that we had, it was completely self-contained. There was a portable hand generator, which to transmit, we had to have someone to wind the handle, and that was sufficient. The receiver was a small set the size of a domino box with a battery the same size, and it would last for a long, long time, and it was quite adequate. We could go anywhere with that set.
What methods did you have for reception?
In what way do you mean?
How did you go about receiving messages?
Well, we took the messages when we were on the schedule. By our various procedures on the air, we knew what we were going to send and would tell them. The base station would tell them what messages they'd got for us.